Welcome to America, the prison capital of the world. More people are behind bars here than anywhere else on the planet. Before COVID, the number of prisoners in America was 2 million. But the virus emptied out the cells of the nonviolent criminals. Now what? Do we jam them all back in? Or do we take a good long look at the business of lockup in this country? That is the question tonight on Banfield. Hi, everybody. Mass incarceration or decarceration? That's the question. Has COVID taught us anything about the number of people we lock away in this country or the level of crime that requires it? The pandemic prison population in America fell from 2.1 million to 1.8. Now, understandably, victims were mad, but advocates for social justice said we may not need to keep so many people locked up. Tonight, I'm joined by Jeff Coutts. He's the director of an initiative called From Punishment to Public Health. It's based at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Jeff, thanks so much for being with me. I don't think this is an easy question to answer, but I'm going to give you the first crack at it. Did we learn something over the last year that can be helpful going forward?
I think we learned many things that can help us going forward, namely the importance of planning for a pandemic like this, if it should happen again. The criminal justice system, like many of our infrastructure systems, was caught off guard. And the level of communication available that we would want to see, and didn't have the planning in place that would allow us to respond to an issue like a contagious pandemic.
I mean, one of the first things before we even get to what life was like for the people who were locked up was how the justice system all of a sudden came to a screeching halt. The lawyers weren't even allowed in to the prisons, and that meant that prisoners who were trying to move forward with their cases couldn't, because they didn't want to get on phone systems and have conversations with lawyers, because that's not protected or privileged.
Certainly access to your client during the pretrial stage or when you're negotiating a plea deal is vital. And not only was access to clients delayed in terms of lawyers visiting the jail setting or the prison setting if you were up for parole, but also the courts themselves slowed down. And so arraignments were halted. Many people in places like New York City were given court dates 3-4 months out for simple arrests like petty larceny, shoplifting, something like that. So there were really a lot of disruptions to regular business as far as the criminal justice system goes.
So eventually, you know, as soon as everybody started to realize the pickle that we were in across this country, and not just in the prisons started to realize they needed to let some of these people out. And as I looked at the numbers, they seemed so dramatic. 300,000 inmates were released. But then I looked at the population's still at 90%. We're still at 90% capacity in the country. So can you help me figure out what those contours actually mean?
So I think we find ourselves in a real moment of opportunity to accelerate our trends away from incarceration and towards investment in community-based services like mental health care, substance use treatment, affordable housing, summer jobs programming, things that we know can reduce and prevent crime. Many of the people who were released during COVID were scheduled to be released soon thereafter. And so they maybe got 6 or 12 months knocked off of a shorter sentence. We saw significant reductions in the jail populations as well, as judges made different decisions about whether to set bail on a low-level crime or whether they were going to set bail and try to detain somebody pre-trial.
So, you know, there'll be a lot of people watching saying, look, I have bigger fish to fry in society. And why should we be so concerned about, you know, people who are in jails or prisons? I feel very strongly about jails because you can't determine that those people are guilty. So you shouldn't just be giving them early sentences while they're awaiting their adjudication. But then I saw the numbers of people who contracted COVID. And that was really distressing. More than 300,000 prisoners contracted COVID, and more than 2,000 people died. So I'm wondering if that was, well, first of all, it's inexcusable. These are not death sentences that we, you know, have handed down to inmates. So that on its surface is just wrong, no matter how you feel about incarceration. But is this an infrastructure problem, an overcrowding problem, a management problem? You know, your initiative deals with health. Do we not maybe focus on the health of inmates, because they still deserve health if they're incarcerated?
Certainly, and they have a constitutional right to health. That has been read into the Fifth Amendment prevention of cruel and unusual punishment. And so when we look at carceral settings, one of the first strategies that we had to prevent the spread of COVID-19 was social distancing or physical distancing, right? Something that's just not possible. I mean, we had many situations where the strategy to prevent spread was to have people who were sharing a cell sleep head to foot so that they were not so close to each other while they were sleeping. So many of the steps to release people early was to create enough space in the units so that they could space those people who were already medically vulnerable, more susceptible to more severe symptoms from something like COVID-19. One of the realities of our carceral state now is we've been incarcerating people for so long that we have tens of thousands of elderly individuals who are in our state prison system. And that was one of the calls for many of the older medically vulnerable people to be released, along with those folks who were serving shorter sentences.
I would just assume, Jeff, by the way, when you say that the older inmates were released, this is probably stereotypical, but my guess would be that they're maybe a little less dangerous. Is that true?
Absolutely. So once somebody reaches the age of 55, their likelihood of committing a crime upon release is no greater than the general population. And so there are overwhelming reasons for us to be focusing on that population, both because of the reality that end-of-life care is quite expensive in general, even if delivered in a community setting. And we are spending a lot of our scarce public resources to deliver medical care in a carceral setting, which doubles, if not triples, the costs of these types of things.
So you make a strange bedfellow when you say that, right? Because if someone's watching saying, I don't give a hoot about inmates, they do care about tax dollars, right? And what you're saying to me is that the older the inmate, the more we're all going to pay for all the medical problems that they have, which, by the way, are more, right? When you're incarcerated, you're not the average Joe out there walking to the bus stop, et cetera. You are more susceptible to have a need for treatment in the prison system, right?
Absolutely. And we find often, and the research bears this out, there are a number of really wonderful internists that work with elderly populations in prison settings. And they, in looking at the types of ailments that these individuals either develop while they're inside or arrive to the carceral setting with, they tend to age more quickly on the inside. And so their hypertension, their diabetes may actually worsen due to lack of access to care, different types of medications that are available on the inside. And so we know that many of the folks who are incarcerated currently could do well in community settings and would not be a greater risk to the general public if they should be released.
So I know that the business of incarceration is mighty and booming and very clever. But do you think that the public and the legislation gets it? And then when I say that, legislators don't want to do a whole lot to make life easier on inmates because it means you're not going to be holding office for much longer. But is there an argument that can be made to assuage that by saying, I'm sick of paying for it, and I think you, the community, is sick of paying for it too. We should be building a better mousetrap. Sorry for the pun.
I think that tide has shifted, actually, politically. I think that the general public has a better understanding of how our criminal justice system works than it did 10 or 15 years ago. And pounding the podium that you are tough on crime, if you don't have a strategy for actually dealing with those folks who are flowing through the criminal justice system, I don't think that's a viable political standpoint right now. A number of years ago, there was a group that developed called Right on Crime, because it wasn't just Democrats and people in the left wing that were pushing for decarceration. It was people on the right who were recognizing this was a poor use of government resources. We were spending a lot more money than we were 10 years ago, and we're not getting better results from our carceral system. Crime was continuing to go down around the country, around the world, throughout the 90s and the 2000s. And similarly to where people had introduced things like drug courts, mental health courts, to avoid sending people to prison in the first place and finding them adequate treatment and resources in the community, crime was still going down in those areas. And so New York State and New York City saw significant crime reductions at a time when we significantly reduced our prison population, cut it in half, cut our jail population at Rikers Island in half, and saw the same crime reductions that the rest of the country was seeing at the same time.
And I'm going to go into those numbers a little later in the show. The fact that, you know, everybody expected if you're letting all these people out, well, crime rates are going to go up. There are certain cities, and not just a few of them, where the actual crime rates went down in certain crimes. I'll get into that in a minute. But first, I want to just dig down a little more on the money. This one hurts. I was lucky enough to be cognizant in 1975, although I don't remember this. We spent $7.4 billion on jails and prisons in 1975. And now look at the number in 2015. If you're not looking at your TV, people, look, it's crazy. $87 billion. There is no math in this show, but I can tell you just looking at those numbers is like jaw-dropping. Is it just numbers, people? We just put a lot more people in? Or did we do it inefficiently, Jeff?
Well, both. We spent a lot of money building new jails and prisons. And we spent a lot of money filling those cells. We spent money on courthouses. We spent money on increased police forces. And as I alluded to earlier, people want to see the benefits of that spending. They want to see return on investment from a government perspective. And when we stop seeing that over a consistent amount of time, the general public starts to look at that and says, is there not a better option out there? And I think that we know enough now to say we have many options out there. I alluded to drug courts and mental health courts earlier. We're starting to move further upstream in the system. We're starting to intervene in cases at arraignment or even at the moment of arrest, where we send a peer mentor out to the precinct to engage an individual who's been arrested for possession of illicit substances and engage that person in a candid conversation about how their continued drug use is not helping out their life. And what are they going to do to take steps towards being a more proactive member of their family, a more productive member of society? And if we start to engage people and provide them the services that they need, rather than just throw them away in a cell, we're going to get better return on that investment. And I'll end that comment with the iron law of incarceration is almost everybody who we send to prison comes back to the community someday. So it is a myth that we are solving crime by just isolating people, because they will eventually return. And we've been locking people up for so long, we just have a revolving door now, people going in and people going out.
I'm glad you mentioned that because the recidivism rate is 77%. For anybody who's watching right now, they're like, what? Clutch your pearls. That's a lot of people going in and out the revolving door. Hey, Jeff, I really appreciate the work you do and the information. It's I believe this is a very nonpartisan issue. It's about money and it's about safety and it's about, like I said, building a better mousetrap. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it. It's good to talk to you. And to what Jeff said, imagine 77% recidivism. Are we making criminals behind bars? Like putting them in and making them worse, making them more expensive, making them a burden on us? Those questions coming ahead next. Welcome back to a very special episode of Banfield. Did you know there are nearly 2 million people locked up in this country? It's the highest number in the world. So you would assume that we're a lot safer, right, than every other country out there. I don't know. We may instead have just created a prison industrial complex instead. And if that's the case, we're just paying a lot of money and we're not getting return ROI. So I'm joined by Nicole Porter. She's the director of advocacy at the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit organization focused on sentencing reform, voting rights, and eliminating racial disparities in the justice system. And I'm also joined by Insha Rahman. She's a former public defender and the vice president of advocacy and partnerships at the Vera Institute of Justice. Thank you, ladies, both of you, for joining me. So I want to begin with you, Molly, if I can, or rather, Nicole, if I can, because the statistics on the number of people behind bars compared to the population of inmates around the world is a bit staggering. As I last saw, and I think these are pretty darn close, the U.S. has 5% of the world's total population. But our incarceration population is 25%. So that would lead me to think, Nicole, that we're much, much safer than every other country out there, are we?
Well, it certainly speaks to the choices that the United States made when violence increased here in the 70s and the 80s. But it's also important for your audience to know that violence increased in other parts of the world, too, including Germany and in Sweden, and those countries did not choose to do what we did in terms of expanding their prison capacity and disappear people behind prison walls. They responded with expanding services to prevent people from coming in contact with the legal system to begin with. So our incarceration rate is a reflection of policy choices, and other countries made different choices during the same period of time when they also experienced increases in violence as well.
So, you know, Insha, I know that your focus is really in bail and the system of bail in this country. And generally speaking, I think the average, you'll have to correct me if I'm off, but the average bail in this country is around $10,000, which equates to about 8 months wages or salary for the average inmate, which, you know, that means you're staying in. You're not going to get out on bail. There's a lot of different, you know, discussions around that, meaning you have to make it high or somebody will, you know, jump bail and what's the point of staying. But at the same time, doesn't it mean that we all have to look after that guy or that girl for all that time? And they may very well be better out on their own, paying for their own three squares. What's your view on that?
So my view is that we actually make a mistake in assuming that we need to set bail in order for people to come back to court or stay safe in the community while they're pending trial. So as you noted, I was a public defender for many years before coming into doing criminal justice policy work. And so I saw day in and day out judges use money bail and set bail at $500, $1,000. And it was always unclear when judges set bail, what do they really intend? For this person to be released and go home to the community, to their families, or to stay in jail? And that's fundamentally the problem with money as the determinant of whether somebody should be released pretrial or remain detained. And the problem is when we use money, we know that people can't afford it. The Federal Reserve did a study that found that over 40% of Americans don't have $400 to cover an emergency. And as you noted, the average bail in this country is $10,000 or more. What we found in places that have moved away from using money bail, like the state of New Jersey, Washington, D.C., New York State, and a number of other places that are not just blue or Democratic places, but places like Kentucky even, that if you release more people pretrial, actually you see better rates of people coming back to court and staying arrest-free. And the reason is that jail itself, remaining behind bars, has a quote-unquote criminogenic effect, which means that the fact of being incarcerated, of losing your bonds with your family, your home, your employment, actually means that somebody's more likely to be arrested and involved in the criminal justice system in the future.
So jump in here, Nicole, and tell me where we're making mistakes. Like, what crimes right now, I guess the better question would be, you know, which crimes merit prison and jail time for sentencing, and which crimes that we're currently sending people away for maybe don't?
Well, state and the federal criminal code are incredibly complex. There are criminal statutes that can trigger prison admissions and prison sentences that overlap, giving a great deal of discretion to prosecutors and legal practitioners in terms of whether or not a person goes to prison and the length of time that they're subjected to. think it's important to recognize that in the United States, we send people to prison for things they just would not get sent to prison for in other parts of the country. That's one reason why the United States has such a high rate of incarceration. There are a range of underlying causes for the high rate of imprisonment. One key driver that the National Academy of Sciences found in its seminal study back in 2014 was that the high rate of policing has increased, certainly in the early 1980s, leading to a higher chance that U.S. residents will come in contact with the police. Once, because of that higher chance of coming in contact with the police, U.S. residents have a higher chance of getting charged with a crime. Once charged with a crime, they have a higher chance of getting sentenced to prison. And once they get sentenced to prison, they have a higher chance of going to prison for longer. So there's a range of practices that could be examined if decarceration were a serious effort by federal and state lawmakers, including what can lead to interaction with police to begin with. The United States has gone through a reckoning over many years now, starting even before Ferguson, but I was going to start with Ferguson this afternoon, to a range of other localities that have gone through similar experiences, just like in George Floyd's home over the last year, and in other communities like in Kentucky, where Breonna Taylor's, the outcome of her interaction with law enforcement has driven a conversation there and nationally. So what leads to interaction with police is one place to start. And then the length of imprisonment that is influenced by the range of sentencing practices, from mandatory minimum sentencing to truth in sentencing practices that have driven up lengths of imprisonment.
It feels like it's almost political. I got to be honest. Like, sometimes I think people scream and yell, put them in jail, when they're angry at the other guy. But then if it's your guy, it's like, well, wait, he needs a break. You know, I feel like a lot of it has to do with where you politically stand. But Insha, let me ask you something, because it feels like there's not a whole lot of consensus here among society as to what is our goal of putting people away. Is it, number one, just to remove them from the flock so they can't do any more damage? Is it to punish them? And that's, you know, retributive for the victims out there. They want some justice, right? Or is it to rehabilitate them so that when they eventually do get out, they're not going to continue to be a problem for us? I think it's all three, but I don't think that we're doing it right. And I certainly think that we're getting that third one wrong. I feel like we're making more criminals when they're in the clink than helping them to be productive citizens when they get out. And we're spending a lot of money doing it.
It's the worst return on investment that we make in this country, our criminal justice system. You noted $85 billion a year is what we spend on incarceration alone, but we actually spend $284 billion if you include policing, arrests, as well as probation and parole and other parts and the courts. And what you saw earlier is that we know that 77% of people who are released from prison end up back, in the system within 5 years. And that tells us the status quo isn't working. I want to highlight something that Nicole said that is so important, which is there are 10.4 million arrests each year in this country, and only 5% are actually for crimes involving an allegation of violence. And so, yes, all three of the reasons that you said earlier are deployed as political rhetoric to justify the mass arrests and mass criminalization and mass incarceration as we know it. And yet, when we actually look at the numbers, we should be incarcerating no more than 5% of people who are arrested if the goal is simply public safety. And even then, we've seen that when people are charged with serious offenses, they can and should be given the option to stay in the community if that is good for public safety, which it often is. But the truth is, we do this in the name of victims, and we say victims want this. But every time we've actually polled and surveyed victims, what they want is to know that what happened to me will never happen to me or to anybody else again. And jail and prison doesn't prevent that. It just kicks the can down the road. Having an intervention that is a restorative intervention, one that makes people be accountable for their actions, which is community-based, is actually the best investment in public safety. And by a margin of 3-1, victims say, that is what I want to see when given the choice between a community-based sanction or incarceration.
I mean, that is really interesting, that statistic. Insha Rahman, thank you. And Nicole Porter, thank you as well for your insights. Coming up after the break, why some states have been able to actually bring their incarceration rates down and, get this, bring their crime rates down at the very same time. What is their secret? That's next. Welcome back. The COVID pandemic saw the U.S. prison population plummet for the first time in a long time. Big question is now, do we go back to the way things used to be and crowd the inmates back into those cells? Or is there a new prison model that might be starting to emerge? I am joined by Molly Gill. She's the vice president of FAM. It's a nonprofit and nonpartisan sentencing reform organization. I'm also joined by Denise Rock. She's the executive director of Florida Cares, a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of incarcerated people. Ladies, thank you so much for being here. Let me start with you, Molly. 35 states, it turns out, emptied out some cells and lowered their prison population. And while you might think that the, you know, crime would go up, at the same time, the crime went down. Crime rates actually went down. Can you explain that? Is it unrelated? Should we not, you know, attribute things to COVID necessarily that just seem at face value to give us wisdom?
Well, I think the 35 states that you're referring to actually reduced those prison populations before COVID even happened. And that was because states all across the country started looking at their prison populations and saying, this is a huge part of our budget. It's extremely expensive. Are there people in there who don't need to be in there? And do we have sentencing laws that are filling our prisons unreasonably, putting the wrong people in for too long? And so 35 state legislatures over the course of the last 30 years have either eliminated a lot of the mandatory minimum sentences, for example, or they've scaled those back dramatically. And what they see in that is when you put fewer people in prison, your costs go down, your prison population goes down. And also they started seeing their crime rate go down. And I think that is because they were making better public safety choices. Instead of filling an expensive prison bed with someone who needed drug treatment, for example, they filled them with someone who had committed a more violent or serious offense. And I think those changes have really led to positive developments in the way that we're thinking about prisons in this country and our prison population.
So I'm glad you mentioned the drug incidents, because I want to play for you some interviews with two people who actually ended up being let go. They were released during pandemic, and it's possible that that's going to be reversed and they're going to have to go back in and be incarcerated. But they were involved in drug offenses, nothing violent, but drug offenses. So have a look at this, and I want to ask something about it on the other side.
They're talking about sending me, myself, and about 4,000 others back to prison. That would really be devastating to my family. As you see now, I'm in truck driving class. So I would just ask that you would just please consider the progress I made. I'm not out here committing any other crimes. I'm just here trying to learn a trade and just better myself.
Since being home, I've reunited with my family, my children, grandchildren, my parents, and my siblings. Each day, I homeschool my granddaughters, one of which has special need. I then work a full-time second shift job so that I can help provide for our household. So how do I explain to my family that even though I'm doing everything as I should now, I might have to return to prison? I ask you, please, please, please rescind this memo and keep us home.
So, the piano music, boy, it tugs at your heartstrings. But at the same time, I think there'd be a lot of people out there watching, Denise, who would say, you know, okay, so you were trafficking in crack cocaine, not both of them, but and, you know, gosh, I lost my son to crack cocaine. So why should I feel bad for you? And why should I fall victim to the piano music? Crime is crime. And if you do the crime, you do the time. Where is that wrong?
Well, I think for one, the crime and the purpose of prison should be to protect society from people that are violent. So when we're talking about drugs or doing crack, I don't think that is a prison, a reason for someone to go to prison. While a mother may have lost a child from crack, the person that's in prison is typically a user or somebody struggling themselves who needs the opportunity to be surrounded by their family, by counseling, by opportunities for healing and growth, and the prison system is not set up to do anything like that of its kind.
But at the same time, it does keep those people away from committing those crimes, at least for the time that they are behind bars. And I think there would be people who say that if you commit the crime, you know the code and you do the time, and they'd be upset. Listen, no one's going to do an interview saying, I should be right where I belong, behind bars here. They're going to say, for God's sake, help me out. I'm doing everything I can. I want out, right? That would be the natural response to someone who's locked up. They don't want to be there. Right, Molly?
Well, I think of course, people commit crimes. They should be held accountable. That's what FAM believes. The question is, are they doing the right amount of time? Does the punishment fit the crime? Does it fit the person? And as Denise said, is that time actually making people better? Are we rehabilitating people so that they don't come back to prison? And prison, as you've described, you know, is we have a very high recidivism rate. Clearly, prison is failing to make people better. And so we really have to question what is the value of that. And also we have to ask, you know, what is our return on investments? You know, if it's between putting a person who committed a drug offense in prison and someone who killed someone, you know, that's, I think, a choice everyone knows how to make. Prisons don't grow on trees, and money doesn't grow on trees. These are public safety choices that we're making. And when we decide to spend money on the wrong people, we are saying that we are going to spend less money keeping us safe from the right people.
So, Denise, help me out with something. I think a lot of people don't know what it is like. Obviously, if you haven't walked in the shoes of an inmate, you don't know what it's like to be locked up. And they may say, well, I don't care. It's not supposed to be a nice place. It's supposed to be punishment. But if their only view of what the prison business is orange is the new black, you know, and having some of the luxuries curtailed, or, you know, MSNBC lockup or something like that. And the pictures that we're running, they don't look so bad. Is that wrong? Is the incarceration experience entirely different than the images we see in the media?
I think it's very different, particularly here in Florida. People think that our prison system is filled with young people. Our prison population, a quarter of it is over age 50. So we have an elderly prison population. It's very common in the Florida prison systems to watch men and women walking around with walkers, wheelchairs, canes. and I don't think that that's very often the picture that I see out there. It's like stepping into a third world country in Florida, at least as far as services are seen. The cell is, you know, 8 by 10, where two people live in that cell. It is, you know, quite uncomfortable. Those are wool blankets that you're seeing in those photographs. And those exist in every Florida Department of Corrections, and they have to be on that bed all the time. It's 92 degrees out here today. So I think that some of the situations and some of the conditions are brutal, especially for when you are not a violent offender, or you're a drug offender, or someone who's violated probation, or someone who has driven with a suspended driver's license. Now, these are things we really send you to prison for 5 years in Florida. 10 years.
And important to remind people that, you know, if you feel that that's great, don't forget you're paying the tab as well. And it is expensive. Mm-hmm. Molly Gill and Denise Rock, thank you both. I really appreciate you being here today, and also your information as well. Coming up, back in 1993, his 12-year-old daughter, Polly, was kidnapped and murdered. And the person who did it had just recently been paroled. Mark Klass will join me to talk about what he thinks about letting people out of prison early or clearing cells because we're overpopulated. That's next. In 1993, 12-year-old Polly Klass was kidnapped from a slumber party at Knife Point. Then she was raped and murdered. The perpetrator who did that to Polly had recently been paroled. Her father, Mark Klass, became a child advocate and established the Klass Kids Foundation, and he joins me now. Welcome, Mark. It's been a while since we spoke. How are you?
I'm well, Ashley. It's very nice to see you again.
It's good to see you again, too, and I'm glad we can talk about this topic because, you know, for the bulk of the program, we've been talking about the benefits of releasing, you know, prisoners and inmates. But there's a whole other side of this, and that's you, the person who's been the victim of justice. And I know you would feel differently about a lot of the things that we've been talking about.
Okay, well, you know, what we realized early on in Polly's situation is that she was let down. She was victimized by the system, a system that was perpetrating the big lie of incarceration. And when I say the big lie, I mean that in a court of law, a judge would hand down a sentence of 25 years to life or some such sentence. And the public would go, well, great, we aren't going to have that individual to deal with for 25 years. But the reality is that most of these individuals back in the early 90s were spending maybe a third of their sentence behind bars, or maybe in extreme cases, half of their sentences behind bars. And Pauly's killer is really the perfect example of that. He was released in July of 1993 after serving 50% of his sentence for his second kidnapping conviction. So he was out after only 8 years. And 3 months after that, my daughter was dead. And I think that people galvanized around that. It certainly prompted the three strikes petitions that were out there, the three strikes movement, and people were starting to ask for some kind of accountability in the criminal justice system. And so we got involved in some things. We got involved in things like three strikes and you're out. And we got involved in truth and sentencing, and ultimately in things like Megan's Law. And within 10 years, by the year 2003, both violent and property crime in the United States had been cut in half. And now everything's reversing and reverting back to as it was in the early 90s again.
Yeah, it's really confusing for the news consumer out there, because on one hand, you see headlines day after day saying it's going to be the summer of violence, that murder rates are going up and violent crime is going up as, you know, policing gets challenged, right? And then you hear on the other side that 35 states reduced their prison populations and their crime rates actually went down for certain crimes. So I'm trying to sort of, I mean, it's never really black and white. There is always an apple and an orange that can't be perfectly, you know, compared. But what, sure. Where do you come in with the COVID argument that these guys, other than the guy who killed Pauly, who did mm-hmm. get the death penalty and sits there, as I understand, still waiting for his day of reckoning, these people who died of COVID in prison, they weren't sentenced to death, and yet they were kept in those jails and they died because of it.
Well, you know, and neither were the other 500,000 people that have died of COVID were not sentenced to death either. But the reality is that prisons exist in order to be able to segregate the population, to segregate the criminal population from law-abiding citizens. So given the fact that their specialty is segregation, why can't they do that within the prison system itself? Take COVID patients and put them in certain cell blocks so that they don't have contact with non-COVID patients. They've got, you know, Ashley, the only guaranteed health system in the United States that I'm actually aware of is in the prisons. They're guaranteed health care, unlike you or I. So I think that this is something that could have always been handled internally, and that they just use the COVID as an excuse to further empty the prisons and cut their own bottom line.
So it's you kind of think, well, maybe we got them overcrowded and the facilities aren't big enough so that if we do have a situation like that, we can't spread them out and put them, you know, safely into some kind of segregated system like you're mentioning, because clearly they were sleeping, you know, toe to head as their social distancing. But we have roughly 2 million prisoners. So the conundrum, Mark, becomes build more prisons and span out the population. And then that means the rest of us and, you know, taxpayers just got to keep paying this crazy, you know, prison industrial complex. Does that sound like the right answer, or are we just not getting it?
Well, first of all, Ashley, in the state of California, they're closing prisons. They're not building new prisons. They are doing everything they can to empty the prisons. And in fact, a new initiative was just introduced about 6 weeks ago that said they are going to early release 76,000 prisoners in the state of California, including violent prisoners, including three strikers and second strikers. So, you know, I think when we talk about the cost of crime, you can offset the cost of paying taxes and incarcerating, using that money to keep a dangerous person behind bars. But conversely, if you let that dangerous person back out onto the street, then the taxpayer is burdened with the costs of protection, of getting alarm systems, of purchasing guns, of perhaps getting some kind of security in the neighborhood, of higher
or insurance. having to pay, you know, their local police detachments, etc. Mark, hold on for one sec. When we come back after the break, I want to ask you a little bit about whether some of these reductions in, you know, or at least calls for reductions in inmate populations is misplaced compassion. Passion, as I think you've said it, financial bottom line. And then there's that other thing, which is the Kardashian effect. I want to ask you about that next. Back now with Mark Klass. Mark, I know you said that this push for reducing inmate populations across the country is either misplaced compassion or financial bottom line. I want you to dig in a little bit more on that, but then touch on the Kardashian effect too, because you can advocate all you want, you know, on Capitol Hill, but when Kim Kardashian shows up at the White House, news covers it live every moment, you know? So I just wonder your thoughts on that.
You know, an interesting story. When back in the day, maybe 10 years ago or so, I was in Washington, D.C. with a couple of other child advocates, and we wanted to see President Bush. He was the president at the time, and we were told that his schedule was completely filled. Well, Ashley Simpson blew into town the next morning, and the White House was doing absolutely everything they could to get her into the Oval Office with President Bush, and she actually turned it down and said there have to be many more important things to deal with in this country than a celebrity meet and greet with the president, between me and the president. So I get that, and it is what it is. You know, there's nothing that one can do about that. But as far as the idea of misplaced compassion and bottom line, I think with all of this emphasis being put on prisoners, and I want to separate what I'm talking about from the systemic racism that has occurred in this country and that is treated the young black man so badly, and that the fact that there are probably many innocent black men or black men in prison right now that are serving inappropriate sentences. But the reality is that it's hard to get into prison, Ashley. You have to do something really bad.
I only have about 20 seconds left, and I just wanted to make sure I also got a plug in for Class Kids, because you do a lot of victim advocacy, and I think your work is important, and I'm always happy to talk to you. I hope you're doing okay, Mark.
Thank you, and you too, Ashley. It's always a pleasure.
Good to see you too, and thank you everyone for watching this special edition of Banfield. We'll see you again.